Good morning. Like Dean said, I'm on staff here at Christchurch. I work mostly with our 6th through 12th grade students, but I'm excited to be here for the 7th week of our 7 signs in John's Gospel. What I love about this series is that each passages that we've worked through in the last month and a half have shown us a miracle that reveals the identity of Jesus in some way and calls us to faith in that person. Before we get into that, I want to know who here is feeling the late winter blues today, especially, right? Yeah, this is like the bleakest season of the year, I think. I think like the end of February through the middle of March is like maybe the hardest time of year seasonally. All of the warmth and sentiment of December has long since been forgotten. All of our January optimism about how much better our lives are going to be is totally over. We're just back to our bad habits, right? And now we're just like in the thick of it, waiting for the brown and gray of February, March to be driven away by the green and 70 degrees and sunshine of like March and April eventually, hopefully. Dear God, please. And I know you parents in the room who have kids who are in school are about to lose your minds. Right? It's been crazy. Yeah, that weather specifically is really difficult for us to handle is that it makes us feel powerless, which we just like hate, right? That feeling of powerlessness that we have about weather, whenever we encounter that feeling in life in general, we avoid it, subdue it. I think there's different ways that people try to get some of that control back, you know, like that sense of control. I think some people, they kind of chase experience, they chase novelty and fun, and so as long as they can like feel good and have some fun experiences and go cool places, like the happiness and joy is only like a plane ticket away or whatever, kind of plagued by a constant sense of FOMO. Other people, they kind of like focus on their tribe of close relationships. So they're like, okay, the world is stressful and going down quick, so I'm just going to focus on my network of close friends and my family, my kids, my spouse, and if I can just make those relationships good and healthy and strong, then like that will kind of like help me stave off the feeling of darkness from the world around me. Some people, they look for work, meaningful work as a way of getting that sense of control back in their life. So if I can find something that is meaningful, if I can build something that will last, if I can do something that's important in the world, then that meaning in what I do will be reflected back and make me feel meaningful, like I'm contributing. And then some people also, they turn to what might be called religiosity for that sense of control. So this would be to say that, like, okay, I know there's a lot of things in my life that are powerless, so instead I'm going to focus on religious practice and religious experience, because if I can take care of my end of the deal with God, then he'll take care of the rest of my life. And so you're kind of plagued by a little bit of a nagging sense that there's always a few more habits that if I just add these, or if I just did this a little more regularly or a little more faithfully, then God would really come through for me. And all of those are built on this idea, this assumption, this belief, that peace, that control, that rest is within our grasp and our strength to take hold of. But the pursuit of that control, the pursuit of that, actually ends up exhausting us. And so we end up lying awake at night in those quiet moments of the day, plagued by this wonder of, is this all there is? Right? Am I missing something? Is there actual, real, substantive rest that I can find in my life? Or is it just this like endless pursuit? And that kind of bleak midwinter feeling that we see around us can sometimes now, this problem is not a Johnson County problem. It's not a 21st century American problem. It's a deeply rooted human problem. It's part of the human condition. And so every culture and every group of people have always had to wrestle with this question of how do I find true, meaningful rest? And so the people in our story today, the people in this passage, are struggling with this question as well. They've had a crisis of life that's led them to a crisis of faith. Now, this is a pretty long story. It's 45 verses. So to help you guys keep track of where we're going, I've divided into three parts I'm going to work through. The first part is Jesus is called. Then Jesus arrives at Bethany, and then Jesus goes to the tomb. So in the first part of this passage, we see that Jesus is called. So to kind of set up this story, the context for it a little bit, Jesus has had a lot of run-ins with the religious leaders of his time. And at this point, things have gotten too hot, too hostile, and so he's kind of retreated to the north, away from Jerusalem, in order to do ministry there and kind of let things calm down a little bit while he and his disciples work there. And while he's up there, a few days north of Jerusalem, he receives a messenger sent from some of his closest friends, Lazarus, Martha, and Mary. These are two sisters and a brother. They're a family that were really close with Jesus. They were longtime partners with him from early on in his ministry through his entire ministry. They were not just people who followed him. They were some of his closest friendships outside of just being his followers. And they lived in Bethany. And Bethany is a small, essentially it's like a suburb of Jerusalem on the eastern side, like a few hours walk from the city. And so they send this messenger to Jesus. Jesus receives this messenger and they say, Jesus, the one whom you love is sick. I think it's interesting that they don't ask for anything, as far as we know. It's a notification. It's a text message. The one whom you love is sick. St. Augustine, who is a North African bishop and pastor in the 3rd and 4th century, he was kind of theorizing about why they didn't ask for Jesus to do anything specifically. And this is what his conclusion was. He said that the reason that they only told Jesus what was going on was that it's because, he said, it's enough that you know, for you are not one who loves and then abandons. That basically, because of their friendship with Jesus, because of their closeness with Jesus, they had this belief that, well, Jesus, as long as you know what's going on in our life, you'll save us from whatever trouble we've come into. They basically are saying, like, Jesus, we're going to let you know what's going on, and then we're going to trust you to do the right thing. And Jesus responds to this messenger in line with that. He says, this sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, that God's Son may be glorified through it. And here again, John repeats explicitly that Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And it's rare in the Gospels it says that Jesus loves specific individuals. Most of the time, his love is in reference to whole groups of people or humanity in general. So when Jesus says that Jesus loved a specific person, it's a really important thing to take note of. Jesus says that there's more going on here than just Lazarus' sickness, that this sickness is going to be used somehow for God's glory. So if you were this messenger sent from these people, if you were Jesus' disciples who knew that he loved his friend who was sick, what you would expect him to do is to either just heal Lazarus without even going there, or to get up right there and like sprint the 2-day journey to Bethany to get there in time. But instead, he waits. He just doesn't go for 2 days. And then eventually he says, once Lazarus has died, he says, now it's time to go. And specifically what he says is very bluntly, when his disciples kind of miss his innuendo, he says very bluntly, Lazarus is dead, and I'm going there to be with him. He says very specifically, he's going there to wake up Lazarus and raise Lazarus from the dead. The sisters of Lazarus, who are, again, Jesus' close friends, they do what every good, faithful person would do. They notify Jesus of what's going on. They ask for his help, basically. That brings us to the second part of the passage, when Jesus arrives at Bethany. And when they arrive, they find that Lazarus has been dead already for 4 days. And I want to tell you a little bit about first century Jewish burial practices, in case you guys have forgotten about them. You know. So initially, what would happen is for the first few days after death, they would put the body in like a room-like cave or tomb. They wouldn't bury the body right away. And for those 3 days, the family and friends of the deceased would go and visit the body, because essentially the rabbinical wisdom of the time said that for those 3 days after death, the soul hovers near the body, and the body might actually, like the person might make a recovery. And this would be essentially, like we do this, happens all the time in hospitals, right? Somebody dies, they are able to resuscitate the person, the person can go on to live a full life. You know, we bring people back from the dead quickly all the time. But then basically after that, after those 3 days, death was permanent, death was irreversible, decay had gone too long. But for those 3 days, Mary and Martha, his sisters, would have visited at least once and probably more times every single day and checked the tomb to see, okay, we thought he was dead, but is he actually dead? But then after the third day was done, the death was considered final, permanent. So when Jesus arrives and Lazarus has been dead for 4 days, we know, and they know, that Jesus is too late in their eyes. He missed it. He missed his window of opportunity to bring Lazarus back. The death was permanent, irreversible, and certain. Now, as Jesus arrives at Bethany, he has 3 encounters with people. Before he even gets to the village, Martha comes out to meet him. She comes out to confront him. Now, she's the kind of family member who, when somebody dies, she doesn't stop moving. She's arranging for casseroles. She's making sure everyone has a place to stay. She's making sure the flowers get bought and put in the right place and the cards get delivered, all those things. She's a hustler in that way, right? She's going for it. So before Jesus even gets to the city, she goes out to confront him. And she confronts him with this really hard truth. If you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Man, that's a sharp greeting, right? She has this kind of like frustrated faith. She believes in the power of Jesus. She says explicitly, you could have saved him. I believe you could have. But she's been disappointed and let down by the fact that he didn't, by the fact that he let Lazarus die. Sending a messenger ahead showed that she believed that he loved them and that she believed that he could save Lazarus. And so she's left with this apparent lack of action leading her to ask, is friendship with Jesus just a sentiment? Is it just a feeling Jesus has about us? Or does it actually change things? Does it actually change the way that our lives pan out or not? She implies, by what she says, she implies that Jesus wasn't there, that he didn't show up when he was needed. But she's still not giving up. She says, I know even now that if you ask, God will give you whatever you ask. So she still has faith, even in the midst of her frustration. And Jesus doesn't defend or excuse himself. He doesn't feel the need to defend his reputation from her. He simply asks her to faith. He says, your brother will rise again. Essentially, believe that Lazarus' story isn't over yet. She says, I know he'll rise again on the last day. The last day in the first century was this view of the end times. And in the end times, God is going to touch down from heaven. He's going to destroy, this is what they believe. They believe he's going to destroy Israel's enemies. He's going to reinstate the kingdom. He's going to put a new king on the throne. And he's going to raise all the people who were righteous, who died under oppression. He's going to raise all those people so that they can have a fresh start at life in this new kingdom. So when she says, I believe he'll rise again on the last day, she's not just talking about some vague idea of some afterlife. She's talking about a very specific expectation of what God was going to do. And Jesus says, he is the resurrection and the life. She was waiting on some intervention of God in the future, some future act, specific work of God. And Jesus says, I am the intervention of God. I am that specific work of God that you've been waiting for. Have faith in me. Jesus asks her, do you believe this? Now, when we hear belief, a lot of times we think of something that happens in our minds, that to believe is to agree that an idea is true, that somebody proposes. The word that Jesus uses for belief here is a bigger word than just something that happens in your mind. It's the difference between me looking at a chair and saying, I believe that chair is sturdy, right? That's one sense of belief with my mind. But the belief that Jesus uses is the belief that I believe that the chair is sturdy and I'm actually going to sit down in it. That's how much I believe it. I'm going to actually put that into practice. I'm going to commit myself to the course of action that flows out of this belief and this truth. When he asks her, do you believe this? Do you believe that I am the resurrection and the life? He's not just asking her, do you agree with this idea about who I am? He's saying, do you trust me? Do you trust who I am enough to act accordingly or not? And she confesses faith. To her credit, in the midst of her frustration, in the midst of her letdown, in the midst of her grief, she still trusts Jesus in spite of it. She says, I believe you're the Messiah. I believe you're the one that God has sent. I believe you're the one that we've been waiting for. And she goes to get her younger sister. Now, while Jesus waits outside this village, he still hasn't gone into the city. Mary comes out to meet him, right? And a crowd follows her, seeing the two sisters grieving, supposing that they're going to the tomb again to weep there. Mary's not so much frustrated as she is despairing. She collapses at Jesus' feet, weeping. See, Martha, when I picture this story, as I hear it, as I read it, I imagine Martha maybe like pointing her finger at Jesus, maybe poking him in the chest. Mary can't even look him in the eye. She collapses at his feet in grief. She has the same message of Martha. It seems like if they've been doing a little bit of triangulating and try to understand what's going on, they have the same message, accusation of Jesus. She says, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. But I don't get the sense of the same edge in her voice. It's a little bit more of a wail, right? She doesn't feel so much let down by Jesus as she does abandoned by him. She counted on him, she trusted him, and yet her brother is 4 days in the tomb, and Jesus is nowhere to be found. And Jesus responds really differently to Mary than he did to Martha. Martha and he had a conversation about theology, doctrine, right? Jesus and Mary have an emotional encounter. When Jesus sees her weeping and sees their friends weeping, it says that he's deeply moved in spirit, which is a really sanitized way of saying he's literally shaking with anger. And he's not angry at Mary or angry at the grievers. He's angry at the power of death to hurt his friends. He's angry at what life has done to them. And then we get the shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. It's the best memory verse for kids because it's just two words. It's really easy to keep track of. Right? It's not a quiet weeping. It's a burst. He's bursting into tears, uncontrollable anger, grief, sadness at the death of his friend, at the grief of his friends. And here's why this picture of Jesus as an angry, weeping friend is important. Because the work of Jesus shows us the heart of God. And a lot of times it's really easy for us to think of God as being some stoic observer of the universe and of our lives, some distant person on a cloud or out in space looking down on us. And here we see that God is not stoic or just an observer, but he's an emotive participant in our lives. He weeps with us. He grieves with us. He suffers with us. Jesus himself knows the end of this story. He knows how this situation is going to turn out, and that doesn't make him able to step aside and just like abstract himself from his grief. He feels it alongside his friends. And this passion is not just an emotion. It's not just a feeling that Jesus has. It actually compels him to action. It's what makes him go to the tomb in a few verses. Then they come to the third encounter, the encounter with the crowds. See, the crowds are grievers from Jerusalem. They're not necessarily followers of Jesus, but they've heard about him enough that they kind of know his reputation. They've heard some people talk about him who do follow him. So they've come to check out what's going to happen, right? They draw two different conclusions. Some see Jesus weeping and they say, oh, well, look how much he loved Lazarus. Look how much he loved his friends. And the others, they're a little bit more skeptical than the idealists. They voice what everyone's been thinking this whole time. Couldn't this guy who can open the eyes of the blind also save his friends from dying? Isn't this within his power? They're not doubting Jesus' power, they're doubting his character. They're doubting his will. They're saying, what kind of guy, what kind of man, what kind of person has within their power to save their friends from sickness and death and doesn't use it? What kind of a selfish person is that, right? And Jesus, again, he doesn't excuse himself or defend himself. He lets them whisper amongst themselves. And instead he says, all of you follow me, we're going to the tomb. Which brings us to the climax of the story, right? Jesus ignores them, ignores their kind of accusations and things because he's not here to prove them by words, he's here to prove himself by deeds. He's here to prove himself by actions. When Jesus goes to the tomb of Lazarus, this is the encounter that the story's been building up to. Everyone's there, Jesus, his disciples, Mary, Martha, the grievers, the Jews. Together they walk up the short distance from Bethany, from the village, to these tombs. And these tombs it's not just one tomb on a hillside. At this point, this is a 1,000-year-old burial ground. And actually, it's still in an active burial site today, 3,000 years old. A lot of the people that you read about in the Old Testament are actually buried on this site outside of Jerusalem. So this isn't just like a nice little hillside with some trees and then like one little tomb here for Lazarus. This is a place where thousands and thousands and thousands of people have been buried, and thousands of families have grieved. This is a true, if you were to think of the place of the dead, this is that place, right? Jesus arrives at Lazarus' tomb, and he tells him to take away the stone, to open up the barrier between the grievers and the grave, right? There's this block between them where they can kind of pretend like things might be different, but when that door is opened, they're staring death in the face. Martha's quick response is, let's not do that. It's been 4 days and the body's going to smell. I think Martha's doing this not trying to be funny or trite, but actually because if she was the one visiting the grave to check it out, she'd probably smelled the body. As she went to go see that if her brother had come back from the dead, if Jesus had raised him already, she'd found for 3 days as she went to go check again and again. More death, more decay, less hope. Jesus nowhere to be found. Jesus asked her again, Martha, if you believe in me, you'll see the glory of God. Trust me. Trust me. And she does. She relents. They open up the grave. And there Jesus is standing in front of an open tomb with a crowd of people around him. And he begins to pray. He says, Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. Jesus shows them that they were wrong about God's abandonment, they were wrong about Jesus letting them down, and they were right to put their trust in him at the very beginning. Their faith in Jesus wasn't misplaced. He was not one who can love and then abandon. And as a sign of that, he has come. In the midst of their disappointment, in the midst of their despair, in the midst of their skepticism and doubt, Jesus remained faithful to them through it all. Their inconsistencies did not make him inconsistent. He remains faithful through it all. And so he calls out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. There's no like fanfare, there's no magic spell. Jesus just calls out to his friend. Now there's some people who sometimes when they're commentators on this passage, they kind of somewhat jokingly speculate that the reason Jesus had to say Lazarus specifically was because his call to life is so irresistible that if he had just said come out or just said come to life, that every single one of these thousands and thousands of dead bodies would have like all raised at once and it would have been too much for the people at the time. So he had to specify which person he wanted to raise at that moment. What Jesus shows them here is that it's never too late for God. Never. Creation responds to his word. And powers so certain, so irreversible as death and literal decay are undone at 3 words from Jesus. Here at the tomb, we see the glory of God revealed. We see the stench of death driven away by the word of life. We see God proving himself to his people, proving himself faithful. In the words of Leslie Newbegin, the glory of God that Jesus is talking about here, has been talking about this whole time, the glory of God is not his praise, it's his activity. It's not just truths about who God is or what God does, it's the opportunity to witness and to testify to the actual real work and activity of God in our lives and in the lives of the people around us. That's where God's glory is proven. That's where God's glory is revealed to us. That's the sign. Now, how do we respond to that sign? I think we respond by putting our faith in the faithfulness of Jesus. Here's why this story is personally really significant for me. I have a younger sister named Reagan, who was born with a rare disorder that meant she was wheelchair-bound. Developmentally, she didn't process much more than a 9-month-old baby. She lived till she was 7 years old. Her disorder meant that she required round-the-clock intensive care from my family. And so from when she was born when I was 6 till the time she passed when I was 11, we all kind of had to dedicate our lives to her care as part of loving someone in our family who was sick. When I was 11 and she passed away, I found myself a lot like Martha was in this story. I was a Christian. I believed in God. I believed in the idea of his power. But I was really, really, really disappointed and angry at him for not showing up in the way that I asked him to, in the way that I wanted him to. In reflecting on this story with my mom, she reminded me of a conversation shortly after where I said that nothing I've ever prayed has been more sincere than this. And nothing I can ever pray will be any more sincere than this was. And God didn't do anything. So why should I pray? Right? I never stopped believing that God was real, but I just thought that he was really cruel and unmoved by my family's suffering and our grief and our cries to him. And what brought me back around to faith in the midst of that frustration, in the midst of that disappointment, in the midst of that abandonment, was that over time, he began to transform grief into grace. The things that had been really, really difficult, really painful, really stressful, and hard as we went through them, as of caring for someone who was terminally ill for a long period of time, we began to reflect on these things not as signs of death, but as signs of life. They were instances that brought us joy, that revealed to us what love really is about, that made us better people, that made us learn how to care for each other better. And so even though he didn't answer my prayer in the way that I asked him to, I saw that he had actually been faithful all through our lives, all through her life, and even in her death. I began to see God heal my family slowly, the way he held my parents together through the hardest thing parents can go through. And through those experiences, I began to get to know a God who actually wasn't cruel to me, who wasn't calloused or mean, but who was loving, who was good, who did not abandon. And once I got to know that person, I loved him. And that love led to trust. You see, trusting in the faithfulness of Jesus is what it's all about. Faith in Jesus, faith in God, is not about believing in an idea. It's about trusting a person. It's about trusting that Jesus is not one who loves and then abandons. That trust in the faithfulness of Jesus enables us to live and die with peace. Trusting that our value and our meaning is not self-made, but is found in being loved by God. And so we don't have to make our own peace or capture our own love or create our own rest out of our own power, but we can actually receive that rest from God through his love. Trusting in the faithfulness of Jesus enables us to live and die with hope. Trusting that the love of God is not just a feeling he has about us, but is actually a promise that he's made to us. It's proven in Jesus' own death, burial, and resurrection. It's proven in his promises to us. That hope doesn't keep us from grieving, of course. Jesus himself wept at the death of his friend, even though he knew that he was going to raise him from the dead. But in our grief, we don't have to despair. Because death is temporary, but the love of God is forever. And so we can put our hope in the glory of God. Not just the glory that is the truth of his identity, but the glory that is the promise of his activity to raise people from the dead, to restore creation, and to call us all to new life in him together. So we all come to this sign, this passage in from different places. Maybe you're fearful. Maybe you're disappointed. Maybe you're feeling restless. Maybe you're feeling skeptical or despairing. Or maybe you feel a little bit like Lazarus, that there's some stuff in your life that's too far gone, that Jesus is too late to save it. And God is calling out to each of us, calling out to all of us, inviting us all to trust in his faithfulness in the midst of our life crisis, in the midst of our circumstance.